Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 9 a.m. Friday, March 15, 2010. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Egan, and there'll be more joining us momentarily. Today, we have seven bills on the agenda this morning. We'll start with Senate Bill 266, Violent Crimes, Emergency Compensation. Senate Joint Resolution 21, Constitutional Amendment, Increased Number of Legislators. Senate Bill 144, Musk Ox Permits. Senate Bill 215, Pioneer Home Drug Benefit. Senate Bill 219, Traumatic Brain Injury Program, Medicaid. Senate Bill 238, Medicaid for Medical and Intermediate Care. And we'll conclude with Senate Bill 226, Crime Lab Life Science Building, dealing with certificates of participation. We'll probably be running into the afternoon. We're going to have our hearings on these bills. The first two are in second reading here at the committee. The rest of them are in first, so we'll be hearing and setting those bills aside. And what we don't complete this morning by 11 o'clock or 5 minutes to 11 or so, we will pick the meeting back up at 1:30 and continue until we conclude, because tomorrow we start the capital budget process and we want to stay on track and finish the presentations from the departments by hopefully Friday afternoon. If not, we'll be going into Saturday. So I'd like to also have the record reflect that Senator Thomas has arrived, and so has Senator Huggins. And the first bill up, Senate Bill 266 by Senator Thomas regarding violent crime emergency compensation. This is the second hearing on this bill. The first hearing was on March 10th. At that hearing, we heard from the sponsor, took public testimony, and set this bill aside for further review. It is the intent today to bring the bill back before the committee, and if members don't have any concerns, I will entertain the will of the committee. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to clarify two issues, basically, that were raised to me, and make sure that they are clear with folks, and that is that the limit of the overall compensation is not increased. This is just the emergency compensation going from $1,500 to $3,500. Has no increase of the cap, which is $40,000 for an individual, and also that the money is 70% of it comes from in the form of felons, so withheld permanent fund dividends, and 30% from a federal grant. So those were the two things that I had a couple of questions regarding, so I thought I'd at least make that clear. Other than that, I'm here to answer any specific questions anybody else might have.
And we have 1-0 fiscal note in the packet. Do we have any questions or concerns from committee members? Okay, Senator Hoffman. one quick thing. We did take public testimony at the last hearing, just as a reminder. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out Senate Bill 266 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move the bill to the next committee of referral. We'll go on to our next item on the agenda, which is Senate Joint Resolution 21, sponsored by the Community Regional Affairs Committee, proposes a constitutional amendment to increase the number of legislators. This is the second hearing on this resolution. We had the first time it was up was on March 8th. It is my intent today to bring the resolution back before the committee and give members the chance to voice any additional concerns, and then look to the committee for their desire. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I'll have Tim Benintendi start out with some opening comments, and then I'll be available for further clarification as well as answers to questions that have come up in the meantime.
Well, Tende, do you want to introduce yourself for the record and who you represent?
Yes, sir. Tim Benintendi, staff to Senator Donald Olson. And this, of course, is the resolution that would increase the size of the legislature, the Senate by 4 members and the House by 8 members, running the total to 72. This, of course, had a hearing previously, and I believe population discussion was a significant part of the discussion and perhaps where you left off. And I'll just let it go at that. We know the basics.
We have 2 fiscal notes in your packet, one from the Division of Elections for $1.5 million to cover the cost of printing the balance. We have 1 note from the legislature reflecting the cost of adding 12 additional legislators. Starting in FY13, the cost is estimated to be $6,140,000. And FY14, the cost would decrease to $4,470,000. And we took public testimony at the last hearing. Do we have any questions for the bill sponsor or concerns? Seeing none, Senator Olson, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move and ask unanimous. I move that we pass out Senate Joint Resolution Number 21 to the next committee referral with accompanying fiscal notes as well as the recommendations.
Okay, we have a motion to move the resolution number 21 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move the resolution from committee to the next committee of referral. Go on to our next item of business, Senate Bill 144 by Senator Olson regarding muck ox permits. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent is to hear from the sponsor, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. Senator Olson, would you like to present your bill, please?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. What Senate Bill 144 does is actually, to boil it right down, is gives the some cleanup action. And since this was requested by the department personnel up in the Nome area, the specifics will be presented by Tim Benintendi, who is my staff, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, he will present the specifics.
If you want to introduce yourself for the record again and who you represent and walk us through this bill, please.
Yes, sir. Tim Benintendi, staff to Senator Olson, the bill sponsor. Senate Bill 144 would authorize a second permit hunt for resident and subsistence hunters for the taking of muskox. It would double the chances of taking an animal, but it would not double the bag limit, which currently is 1 per year. Non-resident hunters would not qualify. If a hunter did not harvest a muskox under their first permit, then a second permit could be issued upon application for another chance in a different hunt area or a different game management unit. Musk oxen are the only game animals in Alaska to which the 1 permit restriction still applies. There are 4 game management units where musk oxen are found in Alaska. Unit 18 is Nunavak and Nelson Islands. Unit 22 and 23 is up on the Seward Peninsula and up in the Northwest, and Unit 26 is in the Northeast. The wild musk oxen population in Alaska is currently at about 4,400 animals, and annually between 325 and 350 are available for harvest. Wildlife biologists and regulators within the department have determined that the health and size of the herd is well past the threshold for expanding opportunities for Alaskan hunters. They estimate that a minimal number of additional permits would be issued under this bill, and perhaps 25 more animals a year might be harvested. Under Senate Bill 144, the Board of Game would have the authority to reduce or eliminate subsistence tag and fee requirements. And because SB 144 changes a year from a calendar year to a regulatory year, the department would be able to issue permits for seasons which straddle the end of the calendar year without the hunter having to apply twice for the same season. If passed this legislative session, the new provisions would be in place beginning August. SB 144 carries a 0 fiscal note and has the support of the department. Support from the hunting community in Northwest Alaska includes the Northern and Southern Norton Sound Advisory Committees and the Seward Peninsula Muskox Cooperators Group. And with that, I'll see if you have any questions.
We have any initial questions from committee members? Seeing none, we have 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Fish and Game. We have no one on the online, and we have no one from the room signed up. So that brings us back. Do we have any final questions from
the committee? Final comment, Mr. Chairman. If there are no questions, all this does is, because muskox have been imported and transplanted in the state of Alaska, they're treated with a little different, they're treated differently than other big game animals that are out there. And because of, and what this does is allows the clearing up of confusion that happens out there with hunters. Because they are treated somewhat different, because they are treated differently, there is confusion amongst those hunters that are from the local areas to what they can and cannot harvest. And at this point, there seems to be, there is a requirement that you have to apply twice if for some reason after the new year, you don't get your animal for that particular season. With that, Mr. Chairman, I ask for your support.
Okay. We'll go ahead and set this bill aside. Go on to our next piece of labor here. Senate Bill 215 by Senator Wilikowski regarding drug benefits at the Pioneer's Home. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent is to hear from the sponsor, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today is Senator Wilikowski. If you can please introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and walk us through your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bill Wilikowski, State Senator for Northeast Anchorage. I'm here with my staff member, Shelley Morgan. I also like to acknowledge that I have several other co-primes on this bill, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Davis, and Senator Kukesh. This bill came about after months of discussions between state and federal agencies, veterans advocates, and members of the legislature who sought to reinstate federal prescription benefits for residents at the Alaska Pioneer Homes. This bill will ensure the residents of Alaska Pioneer Homes will continue to receive their federal prescription drug benefits for years to come. Here was the problem that occurred this past year. In April 2009, veterans living in the Pioneer Homes who were unable to administer their own medications stopped receiving the free or low-cost medications which they are entitled to through the Veterans Administration. These veterans were forced to purchase the same medications from the Pioneer Homes Pharmacy. The Pioneer Homes Pharmacy prepares medications in blister packs so that nurse aides can safely and accurately administer medications to the patients. The VA, on the other hand, prepares medications in bottles and cannot provide medications in blister packs, the preferred method of dispersing medicine at the Pioneer Homes, because they do not have the appropriate equipment. The VA doctors, on the other hand, cannot write prescriptions to the Pioneer Homes pharmacy because the Pioneer Homes are outside the VA system. The Pioneer Homes cannot repackage VA medications because the lot number and expiration would change upon repackaging, and this currently is not allowed by state law. Pioneer Homes previously had been placing veteran medications into Monday through Sunday Medisets and determined that this was unsafe. They were concerned that there would be difficulty in determining which pills were taken. So veterans were essentially caught up in the middle of a bureaucratic mix-up between state and federal policies. This resulted in a combined effort between the Department of Health and Social Services, the Pioneer Homes, the Veterans Administration, veterans advocates, and several members of the legislature, including several members in the other body, who spent several months seeking a solution to the problem. The solution was reached. Pioneer Homes involved all interested parties to determine the appropriate protocol for ordering, receiving, storing, administering, and disposing of medications. The Alaska VA Healthcare System and Regional Office Chief Pharmacist and Chief of Staff conducted in-service visits to the Pioneer Homes to ensure nurses are properly administering medications directly from original VA bottles. This bill will ensure that this problem does not happen again in the future. Under SB 215, if the Pioneer Homes identify a safety precaution that prevents them from dispersing medications as they currently are, the state-run Pioneer Homes would cover the cost of medications. However, it is our understanding that the Pioneer Homes do not anticipate any change to what they are currently doing, and this bill has a zero fiscal note. SB 215 prevents the need to recreate the wheel and ensures that individuals who have earned federal prescription benefits will continue to receive their benefits even in the face of future administrative staffing changes. Veterans and others who are eligible for federal prescription benefits will not be denied their low cost or free medications in the future because of the statutory changes in SB 215. This concludes concludes my overview. Happy to answer questions. I believe Dave Cody from the Pioneer Homes is present, and Verdi Bowen, Director of the Alaska Veterans Administration, should be on the line. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at some of the complications that happen out there, and the obviously different ways of doing veterans medications versus what's going on with the pioneers, did any of the veterans suffer any ill effects or any medical complications because of this change in dispensation of the medication?
I'm going to turn that question, not to my knowledge, but I'll ask my staff if she has any additional information on that. Senator.
For the record, my name is Shelley Morgan, staff to Senator Wilikowski. Through the chair, to my knowledge, there were no medical complications. The complication was more of a financial complication that the veterans needed to then pay for medications in addition to the costs that they pay to the Pioneer Homes for services.
Mr. Chairman, just a final comment. When you're a medical care provider and you start having complications like this, it certainly does I think it's a critical thing, and I think it's a very good bill that Senator Wilikowski brought up with that.
Okay. And there is one fiscal note, and it does mention that the Pioneer Homes are already allowing residents to access the federal prescription benefits. So could you help us clarify that particular issue?
The design of this bill is to prevent this from happening again in the future. Right now, the Pioneer Homes is doing exactly what we would hope that they're doing. It's my understanding that in the past, this has happened before many years ago, and the concern is that, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now, with new administrative changes, new legislators who aren't familiar with what we've all gone through, this could happen again. And so this bill is designed so that nobody has to recreate the wheel and this type of problem doesn't ever occur in the future.
Okay. We have 10 fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services. That was the fiscal note I was just referring to. Do we have any other initial questions for the bill sponsor? Okay. Then we'll go on to the online. We have Rick David Rigg from the Vietnam Veterans of America online.
Mr. Chairman, this is Rick David, state president of the Vietnam Veterans of America, who worked with Senator Wilikowski and Representative Guerra, Nancy Dahlstrom, et cetera, last year to fix this problem. You have a copy of my written statement, which should be in the sponsor's package. I would just point out that although we continue to have concerns with respect to a variety of medical issues and how the VA and our Pioneers Homes coordinate those issues, this is a very positive step forward, and it was enabled basically by the group that worked on it and the commissioner, the state commissioner, who made sure that the problem was solved. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. That concludes our off-net. We have one person that signed up in the room, but we'll have them come forward. Director for the Division of Alaska Pioneers Home. You can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Good morning. My name is Dave Cody. I'm the director of the Division of Alaska Pioneers Homes. The department's position on this bill, as previously stated, is that we're neutral. We have a zero fiscal note, and basically the reason for that is because we're already accepting medications from the Veterans Administration and from Indian Health Services, and our nurses do administer them.
Okay. Do we have any questions for the director? Senator Huggins.
Yeah. Dave, thank you very much. I guess my question would be, what if we didn't have this bill? I mean, how does it change your life having this bill versus not having the bill?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I believe as Ms. Morgan stated, it's to prevent this from ever occurring again. As I said, we are doing this.
A follow-up?
No, thank you.
Okay. We have any further questions for the director? Seeing none. Thank you. We could have the bill sponsor come back, please. Senator Wilkowski, you have any final comments on the bill before we set it aside?
Yes, Senator Stedman, just briefly to sort of respond to that. They were doing this for a period of time, the way SB 215 is written, and then they stopped. And then through legislators getting involved in this and other advocates getting involved in this, they started again. And that's what we're seeking to prevent is, for whatever reason, they stopped doing this in the past, and we're trying to prevent that from happening again.
Do we have any final questions, bill sponsor? Okay, thank you. We'll go ahead and set this bill aside, go on to our next item on the agenda, Senate Bill 238 by Senator Davis, increasing Medicaid income eligibility standards for individuals in medical institutions. This is the first hearing on the bill. The intent is to hear from the sponsor, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today to present the bill is representation from Senator Davis's office. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
For the record, I'm Tom Obermeyer, staff to Senator Davis. She would be here, except that she's tied up in the Education Committee. The bill before you is Senate Bill 238, an act amending the eligibility threshold for medical assistance for persons in a medical or intermediate care facility. It amends the eligibility threshold for medical assistance applicants who are in a medical intermediate care facility from a specified monthly amount limit to 300% of the Social Security income benefit rate. In 2003, the legislature changed Alaska Statute Section 4707.020B6, the Medicaid long-term services income eligibility limit for persons in medical or intermediate care facilities from 300% supplemental security income, that's SSI, to an equivalent fixed dollar amount at $1,656 per month. This change created an income ceiling for waiver eligibility, effectively freezing the eligibility limit for the last 7 years, rather than allowing the limit to adjust annually in tandem with the SSI. The result was that small Social Security cost of living adjustments have disqualified many needy disabled people from the program. Near the end of 2008, many individuals who were aged, blind, or disabled and requiring institutional care received notices that they would no longer be eligible for home and community-based services waivers after the 2009 cost of living adjustment went into effect. Because the waiver eligibility limits no longer increased with the cost of living, it placed a number of people over the $1,656 per month limit, or 300% of the 2003 SSI benefit rate. The 2009 income equivalent at 300% SSI was $2,022 per month. Alternatives for preserving eligibility, particularly for those qualifying, for those requiring lifetime or long-term care, include creation of a Medicaid qualifying income trust, also known as the Miller Trust. Trusts have procedural drawbacks, including numerous responsibilities and restrictions, limited access to income, assistance of an attorney, and a trustee to manage the assets. The Supplemental Security Income Program is a federally based disability program for low-income adults over age 65, blind, or disabled. For an adult, the SSI disability requirement is based on the ability to work. An adult is considered disabled if the person cannot do the work that he or she performed before the disability occurred, or cannot do alternate work because of a severe physical or mental condition. For a child to be eligible, he or she must suffer from a serious physical and/or mental problems. For both adults and children, the disability must last or be expected to last for at least a year. Medicaid services are critical to the well-being of Alaska's most vulnerable citizens. Supporting SB 238 will ensure that eligible Alaskans can continue to receive nursing home care and in-home services. It will also save the legislature from amending statutes every year or two as the federal poverty level guidelines and supplemental security income levels increase with the cost of living. I will bring to your attention also that the bill currently has a zero fiscal note and is, I think, an excellent statement prepared by the Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Struer, pages 1 and 2, and I believe he's in the room if you have any questions regarding that.
We have any questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, we'll go ahead and, as mentioned, there is one zero fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services. We have nobody signed up online. Okay, we'll go ahead and come into the room here, work off the sign-up sheet. Daniels? It's hard for me to read the writing here.
Danello.
What's that?
Denise Danello. Danello.
Danello. Well, Denise, if you could help the chairman with the pronunciation so I don't...
Close. Good morning. My name is Denise Daniello, and I'm the executive director for the Alaska Commission on Aging. We are very pleased to support Senate Bill 238. This is an important piece of legislation for older Alaskans who receive small cost of living increases to their Social Security and other benefit amounts. The impact from this freeze, as Mr. Obermeyer pointed out, that from 2003 forward, a small cost of living adjustment to a person's Social Security can put the senior over the $1,656 limit and, in effect, disqualify them from receiving Medicaid long-term support services. These vulnerable individuals are at risk both financially as with regards to their health. Our office first became alerted to this issue around Christmas time in 2008, when many individuals on Social Security who were receiving waiver services were issued notice from the state that they would no longer be eligible for these services after the 2009 Social Security COLA went into effect. They were given the choice of either paying for these services out of pocket or to establish a Medicaid qualifying income trust, also known as a Miller Trust, to preserve their income eligibility. They were very distraught and they called our office for help. Some of these individuals also called their legislators. The Miller Trust reduces one's countable income below the income standard, which is now set at $1,656, so that a person can continue to qualify for Medicaid. The Miller Trust is a useful tool for maintaining income eligibility, but as Mr. Obermeyer, it does have some drawbacks. First, it requires an individual to seek legal assistance from an attorney to establish the trust and then to find a person they trust to manage their account. Some elderly Medicaid recipients have no friends or families they know who can serve as reliable trustees. They must either trust a stranger to manage their money or forego benefits. Some recipients risk their money by having less than trustworthy relatives serve as a trustee. Recently, we learned of a case involving an elder whose granddaughter left the state with the individual's trust account funds. Secondly, trustees have a lot of responsibilities that include registering the trust with the court system, arranging for an identification number from the IRS, setting up a special account with the bank, and securing approval from the Division of Public Assistance for the trust. Trustees are also responsible for properly managing the trust. That includes distributing the correct monthly allowance to the Medicaid recipient, making allowable expenses with trust funds that are not clearly defined by law, which has caused a lot of confusion for trustees, tracking and documenting receipts, and then passing an annual audit with the Division of Public Assistance. Third, it costs money to establish the trust, anywhere from $800 to $1,200, according to estimates from Alaska Legal Services. This fee is paid for by the senior who's living on a fixed income. Fourth, a Miller Trust is irrevocable. In the rare event that a person's health turns around and they're no longer medically eligible for long-term services, they will not have access to the trust funds for their daily expenses. And finally, managing one's own expenses is a matter of personal dignity for many older Alaskans. Being forced to give up this right can be both stressful as well as humiliating, as well as financially risky. The Alaska Commission on Aging supports Senate Bill 231. We believe that this legislation is good public policy in that it promotes more efficient use of public funds, since fewer individuals will have the need to establish a Miller Trust in order to maintain their income eligibility for Medicaid services when they receive that small COLA adjustment to their Social Security. Passage of this legislation will also ensure that eligible Alaskans can continue to receive nursing home care and in-home support services, which are critical to an elderly person's health and well-being.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, next, Sherwood, please.
Good
you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Sherwood. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. As stated, this bill would raise the income standard for eligibility for people who qualify for nursing home or waiver care under Medicaid. Our experience has shown that individuals who exceed the current income standard for these categories use the legal device, the Miller Trust or qualifying income trust, to qualify. So we do not anticipate that raising the limit would increase the number of people receiving Medicaid in these categories. I did want to point out that people who qualify for Medicaid under this category are subject to make a cost of care contribution toward their nursing home or their waiver service care. This is a separate calculation that's done after determining eligibility based on a number of allowances that are given. Nothing in this bill would affect that calculation. The department does not anticipate changing the calculation if this bill were to pass. So individuals' cost of care contributions would stay the same. We do not expect any loss of cost of care contributions as a result of this bill. So, and I'm available for any questions on our fiscal note.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. That concludes our public hearing portion of this bill. If we could have the bill sponsor come forward, please.
Mr. Chairman, since I was not here earlier, I'd like to say that I'm Senator Bennett Davis from District K, Anchorage.
Okay, thank you. And we have any final questions for Senator Davis? Senator Davis, would you like to make any closing comments on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank you for the opportunity and glad you have been able to bring this bill forward. As you can see, that it's an important component, particularly for our seniors and their families, and I encourage you to pass this bill out of this committee immediately.
Okay, thank you. We're going to go ahead and that concludes the work on this bill. We're going to set this bill aside. Go on to our next. Piece of legislation, Senate Bill 219 by Senator McGuire regarding traumatic brain injury. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent is to hear from the sponsor, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. And we have representation from Senator McGuire's office. If you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and walk the committee through the bill, please.
For the record, my name is Esther Chaw, staff to Senator Liesl McGuire. Senate Bill 219 addresses brain injury, which can happen to anyone at any time. Currently, there are about 800 Alaskans hospitalized each year with a traumatic brain injury resulting from falls, car, all-terrain vehicle, or snow machine crashes, domestic violence, among others. An approximately equal number of Alaskans suffer from acquired brain injuries resulting from stroke, aneurysms, or tumors. The populations most affected by traumatic or acquired brain injury are Alaska Natives, veterans, and the elderly. Despite having one of the highest rates of brain injury in the nation, Alaska does not have an in-state program that deals specifically with brain injuries. Often, persons with brain injury and their families have to go to the lower 48 at great personal expense to access rehabilitation services. In order to establish a program and registry, we had to define what traumatic or acquired brain injury. The CS establishes a traumatic or acquired brain program in persons with disabilities rather than disease control and threats to public health as in the original Senate Bill 219. This change was recommended by the Department of Health and Social Services because Senior and Disabilities Services currently manage the Medicaid waivers, case management, aging and disability resource centers, as well as hospital discharge grants. Under current waivers, a person must meet strict financial, physical, and functional disabilities, whereas traumatic or acquired brain injury survivors oftentimes are more affected with cognitive disabilities. With the addition of case management services, an assessment would be made to attach appropriate services rather than assigning them to another service like behavioral health, whose services are not always appropriate for a traumatic or acquired brain injury survivor. The program established in this bill will provide the state with better longitudinal data on traumatic or acquired brain injury, which will position the state to better access Medicaid funds in the future. Longitudinal data consists of the same information on the same subjects at multiple points in time, which allows for observation of changes over time. This bill does not include degenerative brain diseases such as Alzheimer's because the services needed for someone with Alzheimer's are very different from someone with a stroke or traumatic brain injury. A person with an acquired brain injury will need rehabilitation, working to regain independence, whereas a person with Alzheimer's will most likely need respite and other home and community-based services that support the individual and the family. Brain injury case management, post-acute rehabilitation, community reentry, community clubhouses, and long-term housing arrangements are just a few solutions to freeing up dollars and waiting lists in behavioral health, public assistance, juvenile justice, corrections, long-term care, and other existing state programs while getting people back into the community, school, and work. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. We have... Is there any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at some of the demented patients that are out there or those that are borderline demented, if they for some reason have a motor vehicle accident or have some type of insult to their vasculature, are they not eligible then for this?
I believe you may have to ask the department. They may be better able to answer the question. But I know that some of our stuff we... didn't include some like congenital diseases, et cetera, because under current Medicaid waivers, they already can apply for that under a different waiver. So this is just kind of a different waiver that might address the issues that are more akin to acquired or traumatic brain injury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have any other initial questions for the bill sponsor? We have 10 fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services. We have one positive fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services showing an increased cost of $494,600 in general funds and $774,400 in federal receipts. We have several people online, so we're going to, there's seven for those of you that are just curious on the flow here, so we're going to start in Kenai, Kenai LIO. Eric Finn, if you could identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please, and try to keep your comments to a couple of minutes.
Thank you. My name is Eric Fine, and I'm with Abate. And as a motorcycle enthusiast that's been riding in Alaska for many years, I have some concerns about Senate Bill 219. I'm not opposed to Senate Bill 219 completely, but I do recognize that even the most carefully written bill can have provisions in it that sometimes leads to unintended consequences. I believe that this bill has such a provision in Article 5A, Section 47.80.500, Item Number 3. It reads, evaluation of standards and laws pertaining to the prevention of traumatic brain injury and to the treatment, care, and support of persons with traumatic brain injury. It is my belief that if this remains as written, it will eventually lead to a call for mandatory motorcycle helmet law. Alaska does not have a major problem with motorcyclists becoming victims of traumatic brain injuries because we're not required to wear helmets. In fact, the one case in Alaska that I'm aware of is one of the main reasons that I feel the need to modify the language in this bill. Fact is that the unfortunate person that received the terrible injury was not only under the influence of alcohol, but was also speeding and weaving in and out of parked vehicles when the accident occurred. And following this, the state of Alaska, with the assistance of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, they produced a large poster showing the victim sitting in a wheelchair in a darkened room, and the poster described how awful his life now is and how it could have been prevented if only he'd been wearing a helmet. Now, if it had been a don't drink and ride poster or don't speed or ride irresponsibly poster, we would have all applauded this. But instead, we got a misleading portrayal that promotes a mandatory helmet law. So in conclusion, I'm requesting that item 3 be modified to remove the words and the laws, and then after pertaining the words to the prevention of traumatic or acquired brain injury, and so that it reads, evaluation of standards pertaining to the treatment, care, and support of persons with traumatic brain injury or acquired brain injury. And thank you for your consideration and your time.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
We'll go on now to Carl Liebes. If you can identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Yeah, I'm Carl Liebes. I'm a member of the Abate, and I oppose the SB 19 as it's worded, the same as Eric Fine has stated.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
That takes care of the list in the Kenai LIO. In Anchorage, Boyd McPhail, if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, I'm Boyd McPhail. I'm Legislative Affairs Officer for Abate of Alaska. That's Alaska Bikers Advocating Training and Education. I too want to elaborate on what the previous two members have said. Our concern is the wording in on line 3, or page 4, line 6 and 7, to the prevention of traumatic and acquired brain injuries, and with the removal of those words out of this bill, we would have no objections to this bill at all, and in fact, we would probably support this bill highly. The motorcycle community actually only makes up under 1% of all accidents that are out there on the highway. And I have been in the hospitals as a representative of Abate for Christmas in July at Santa Claus, and I have seen a number of children during our Christmas in July run who have been in there because of brain injuries that they had received. 90% of those that I've seen were all inside a car, and it's quite a bad thing to see. However, none of those kids that I've seen were wearing a helmet while inside the car, and I've seen some pretty nasty deformed heads on some of these kids, and it just breaks my heart. But unless if we keep the laws pertaining to the prevention, you're going to have to put helmets on everybody for everything that we do. With that, I don't have any more further statement.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
That takes care of Anchorage. We'll now go to the off-nets. Nancy Burke, if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please. Burkey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Nancy Burke. I'm a program officer for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and the Mental Health Trust is supporting SB 219. We've worked for over 10 years with partners such as the Alaska Brain Injury Network on establishing a program to assist survivors of traumatic brain injury in the state of Alaska, and we view the current bill as a great step forward in assisting us in documenting the incidence of brain injury and learning information about survivors of brain injury and their needs for service delivery. And we appreciate your time, and I'm also available for any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Next on the list is Pat Chapman. If you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, this is Pat Chapman, and I kind of represent myself, but I'm also a host for a traumatic brain injury support group here in Ketchikan, Alaska, and also I collect the trauma data for the hospital here in Ketchikan, and I've been doing this for a number of years, worked on a trauma collection for the brain injury that the federal government did some years ago. I'm in support, definitely in support of Senate Bill 219, because we need to identify early on the brain injured person and get them with somebody managing their case. Here in our area, we've had many people have brain injuries that are not identified as what services they need, and hence they come out of the hospital, they go home, and they're very confused. Their cognitive is, unless they have a really severe physical damage, there's nothing provided for them. And with the case manager on top of things and identifying, these people will be put back into the life that they had or similar by getting the early treatment. I have two cases here in Ketchikan. As one, both of them were falls for some distance. One of them, we managed to get some services because it was a coworker that I knew, and we encouraged. That person is now back to work. The other one did not get the services, and we're still fighting to try to find the services for her. And she's not back to work. We need to get people back into the system and get them off of. If you don't have identification and treatment early on, these people become very frustrated. They know that there's something wrong. They turn to alcohol and they turn to drugs, which then brings us into the legal system of more costs. I have a daughter that was injured in a car accident. She was under 21. She got services. I mean, I'm very fortunate to the state and the federal government for the services, but she was one of the lucky ones. If she had had the accident at this time, we would not, because we do have waivers for under 21, but we have nothing for our older working class folks. So I really encourage you to pass this bill and see if we can get our people back healthier and back into the system working again. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure who to ask this question of, but it was pointed out by Mr. McVail earlier on that the accidents that involve traumatic brain injuries was approximately 1% of the total accidents that are there. Our concern on the Finance Committee is where public funds are being dispensed, and I was wondering if anybody had any information as to, in spite of the low number of motorcycle accidents that are out there, how many of those, or how much public funds are dispensed for those traumatically injured who are hospitalized for extended periods of times, you know, how much of the public funds are taken up?
We'll bring that question back up, I think, when we have administration testimony a little later.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Try to help you with that. Next on the list is Christy Artsu. You can identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Yes. Good morning. My name is Christy Artuso. I am the Director of Neurosciences at Providence, Alaska Medical Center. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and thank you for hearing this testimony this morning. I am calling to support Senate Bill number 219 for a variety of reasons. As you are aware, this bill would give statutory authority to the Department of Health and Social Services to address many of the serious issues that have already been identified in this state affecting Alaskans and affecting their well-being. The legislation would facilitate our ability as a state to provide the essential services to this population of patients who have to date been neglected. just for a little bit of history, in 2008, we treated over 800 patients who were not hospitalized. You heard earlier that over 800 to 900 patients per year are hospitalized, but we're also concerned about those who are not hospitalized. Now, that number of 800 only includes those who presented for care, and yet we are well aware that there are many patients that never present for care because they don't believe that there's anything truly wrong with them. Great example involves many of our athletes, football players, baseball players, basketball players, hockey players, who can sustain a mild traumatic brain injury, which can affect their success in school, it can affect their success with relationships, and yet these brain injuries go untreated as well as unidentified. In Alaska, continuing services for patients with traumatic brain injury are severely lacking, and these services have been identified in other states in the lower 48 and supported by their state governments. These lacking services are related to not only resources, but continuing data collection, reporting, provision of evidence-based care for cognitive disability, which is currently not recognized as an area that we can treat and be reimbursed for. And so we have to look at the needs to develop cognitive services, including community reentry, case management to coordinate care and access to services, as well as supportive environments that need to be created for these patients. We're not only talking about the youth of the state or the motorcyclists or the automobile victims, we're also talking about some of our military coming back into the state. Remember that a cognitive disability, which is associated with a physical injury, affects the individual's ability to sustain employment, it affects their relationships, and it has been shown to contribute significantly to behavior issues that can result in criminal activity. Just one brief example of one patient who was hospitalized here at Providence 2.5 years ago, who was rehospitalized 27 times for behavioral issues over an 18-month period, resulting in over a $1.5 million loss because none of the services could be captured at all.
Could I get you to finish up, please?
Sure. We were unable to provide those services because they weren't available in the state of Alaska. So we would appreciate the Senate committee actually supporting this bill because of the needs of the Alaskans. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Kirsten English? You're up next. If you can identify yourself for the record and who you represent, or Kristen.
My name is Kristen English, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Cook Inlet Tribal Council, and I'm speaking on behalf of my organization. I would like to testify in support of House Bill 219. We think that the increased attention towards TABI would be beneficial in a number of ways. CITC, my organization, operates a very large substance abuse facility. As one example of what we think might be, this definitely shows a connection, if not a correlation, 46% of the patients that we see in detox and in residential substance abuse service self-report some form of traumatic brain injury. And when we include our outpatient numbers, that number still is very high at 37% of people with substance abuse issues who also have reported TBI. We've looked at reports from the State Department of Health and Human Services, and this seems to be a phenomenon that is evidenced statewide. We really feel that by improving the care available for TABI, we will also see added benefits by a reduction in substance abuse. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. C. Murphy, if you can identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
My name is Sean Murphy. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm in support of Senate Bill 219 with the Department of Health and Social Services. I'm recovering from a brain injury. Excuse me. I was in a skiing accident about 2 years ago, and I hit a tree about 30 miles an hour head first. Luckily, I was wearing a helmet. It would have been much worse. 3 days after the accident, I woke from my coma. And my wife realized she had to raise another child. I could not talk, walk, or even feed myself. This bill gives social servers many specifics to help address the issues related to TBI accidents. However, the main reason isn't why I'm calling here is for myself, but it's for the treatment and support of the injury and the members dealing with TBI accidents. As you can well hear, many emotional issues impact the entire family. It was very extremely difficult to obtain this information. A single agency to assist in identifying resources, support groups, etc., would have been much beneficial for families in this situation. As I found out weeks or understood months later, it was the amount of stress my wife had to endure. From first being out of the country, then in Seattle, and then again in Anchorage, my wife had to continually start the process over and over again to get me the treatment I needed. Again, having case management resources needed to aid in the recovery process. While researching these type of injuries, my wife and I noticed that the majority of states had the facilities to assist people obtaining information and contacts needed. We could not find that in the state of Alaska. With the many outdoor activities and the highway accidents, I'm surprised that this was the case. That's the end of my testimony.
Okay. Thank you for testifying today. The final person on the off net is Major Allen. Major Allen, if you can identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name's Major William Allen. I'm the Marine Commander of the forces here in Alaska. I'm calling in support of Bill 219 just to briefly speak on behalf of those veterans, including myself, who have deployed overseas in support of the war on global terrorism and have suffered from exposure to improvised explosive device and the concussive effect that has on the brain. I think we've heard some testimony about the traumatic extent of brain injuries, but there are also those cases that are mild, which is what I have suffered. And the way that the Department of Defense classifies the mild traumatic brain injuries are those that which not kind of expose any type of skull fracture. So basically we see what's kind of a classic concussion injury. And the effects of those mild TBI injuries can be long-affecting and may not heal themselves until months, even possibly years, a year after. My exposure to over 8 IED blasts while I was in Iraq, I was able to function at a high level while I was still deployed, and even when I returned home, when I was able to focus on the care and training of the Marines as we prepared to deploy again. But as I learned, almost like a light switch, when I would go to work, I was able to focus on the things to do to keep the Marines safe. But yet when I would come home and knew that I was in the comfort and safety of the family, it was really when the onset of the symptoms really presented themselves. And so I'm calling just in support of not only those members, as many of the committee know, that retire and make Alaska home, but also for those family members that come home with those veterans and make Alaska their residence. This is going to be something that we're going to have to deal with in the near term as well as the long term as our veterans continue to flow in. That's all I have. Questions.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. That concludes the off-net. We have two individuals that have signed up in the room here. Hodges? Jill? She can come forward, identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and then speak to the bill, please.
Yeah, Yes, thank you. For the record, my name is Jill Hodges. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Brain Injury Network, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 219, and also just wanted to acknowledge and thank the committee. We understand that you're very busy this time of year and really appreciate your efforts in getting this bill heard today. The Alaska Brain Injury Network has basically is an organization of traumatic brain injury survivors and family members, and this group travels around the state and hears firsthand from Alaskans who've experienced traumatic brain injury. We've been to Bethel, we've been to Barrow, Kotzebue, we've been to 20 plus communities around the state, and the stories are heart-wrenching, and they're exactly the same wherever you go. Every brain injury is unique, but the circumstances seem to be similar. I was hospitalized. I had really great care at the hospital. My family was confused and didn't know anything about brain injury at the time. And then I was sent home. And we know from Alaska Trauma Registry data that in the past 15 years, there's been over 10,000 Alaskans hospitalized with a severe traumatic brain injury. And of those, 72% go home with no assistance. And you know, that can mean two things. One, that can mean they're better, they leave the hospital. You know, the job is done, they're fixed. But what we really do know is that traumatic brain injury often becomes a chronic, lifelong condition, but it is a manageable condition. And a lot of us who've been in other states and received care in other states, myself, my family received care in California for my brother, we know what that care looks like. We know what it looks like to go to the hospital, to not know anything about traumatic brain injury, but to get an educational packet that says, this is TBI, this is what to expect. And then your family member to have access to rehabilitation, case management, voc rehab, educational supports, and then watch your family member go through trials and tribulations. They go through the depression, they go through the substance abuse, they go through the cussing you out in frustration. But then you really start to understand as a family that you could work through that. You understand it, you support that person, you don't personalize it. And there's so much that can be done here in Alaska. And what we know is that Senate Bill 219 speaks to the very foundational steps needed. We all have our role, personally, the state, the providers. But what Senate Bill 219 does, it establishes a foundation at the state. It gives brain injury a home. It provides, it makes so that current funding in behavioral health, corrections, and those places is being used more effectively. And then it's investing in a population and a disability that recovery can take place. And so it is a, from our understanding and from looking at state government 30 years ago in Missouri and Washington and Seattle or in Oregon, that this is the same steps that they've had to take. One, establish a registry, identify brain injury as a chronic longitudinal condition. Two, establish a home within state government to serve or to plan directly for that population. And then case management. Case management is the key first step in providing one care to the individual, but for the state government, it is a very smart starting point as well. It brings in federal funding for one, and then it provides care to hundreds of Alaskans at once. It doesn't matter if you live in urban Alaska, rural Alaska, remote Alaska. Case management is then implemented by providers in those communities. And so it's those who know their communities best providing this care as well. And then lastly, case management increases the knowledge within the workforce. We understand in Alaska, workforce is a huge issue, but this is something every state's had to deal with. And a case manager interacts with voc rehab, interacts with the schools, interacts with the rehabilitation group and the medical community. And it's that transfer of knowledge throughout the state that's going to help increase our workforce to better serve and identify this population. And so I just wanted to, again, say thank you. I'm available for to answer any questions and appreciate your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hodges, as some of the concerns have been voiced by a number of people that are opposed or semi-opposed to the legislation is that this data is going to be used to go ahead and put up absurd regulations like having helmets in cars. What can you say to those people that are out there that are concerned about that those specific issues.
And through the chair, I guess the best that I could say to answer that question is that this bill really is focusing on those who are having the injuries at no fault of their own, and that without providing that aftercare, they cannot have the, well, they have limited chances of becoming what they once were. And as for prevention, we understand that the number one cause of brain injury in the state is falls, and that there's going to, we're going to have to look at laws, and we're going to have to look at what can help prevent brain injury, but helmets really aren't the only thing. Falls are number one, two, motor vehicle, and then assault. And so there's a lot to do with assault prevention and substance abuse prevention as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for your testimony. Angela, you want to come forward, please? You could identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and then speak to the bill, and then possibly help Senator Olson with his earlier question, if you
Certainly.
Recall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Angela Salerno. I'm here representing the Division of Senior and Disability Services. I'm a program manager there, and I am the interim program coordinator for the TBI program. Our division, Senior and Disability Services, is the division with responsibility for TBI services and the agency that would be charged with developing and administering the program this bill provides for. In Section 2 of the bill, this bill gives the Department of Health and Social Services authority to seek a Medicaid state plan amendment to add case management services for people with TBI. This would add to our list of optional services. This would be targeted case management, and the projected cost for this service is found in the Medicaid fiscal note that you referred to. In Section 3, a definition of case management is added for people with TBI. We feel that this is problematic. The definition is not consistent with the federal definition of targeted case management, and it could cause the federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to deny any claims that we make for case management services. We suggest eliminating this language and replacing it with a reference to the federal definition that will stop any confusion. It's also much more administratively easy to handle if it were, in fact, referring back to the federal definition. In Section 4, the bill also requires the Health and Social Services to serve people with TBI under a Medicaid waiver. And this could speak to your question, Senator Olson. You'll see that we did not develop a fiscal note for a new waiver because we are serving people with TBI under our current waivers. We have approximately 102 people now that are being served under our waivers. To be eligible for waiver services in Alaska, an individual must meet a fairly high level of need. They must be ill enough, disabled enough, sick enough to be treated in an institution, either a nursing home or an institution for the mentally retarded, so that folks who have only mild or moderate TBI simply do not meet that level of need. They have cognitive disabilities that do not make them eligible. So we feel that we're interpreting this bill to say, direct us to do what we are already doing. If that individual is eligible for Medicaid and functionally eligible, they're already on a waiver. That's the end of my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And the bill sponsor is working on a CS. That'll be brought back at a later date. And if there's other issues at surface, we'll work with the bill sponsor on dealing with some of those issues. Okay, thank you for your testimony. That concludes our public hearing portion. Do we have any final questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, do we have any final comments from the bill sponsor before we set this bill aside?
I would just, through the chair, I would make a comment on the opposition mentioned by the
Could you please bring your mic in a little bit?
For the people who mentioned the motorcycle helmets, it was not the bill sponsor's intention to lead this into a mandatory helmet law, and this was discussed in the Department of Health and Social Services, and we left it to the Health and Social Services Committee, and they chose to leave it as is, but it is, I believe, the sponsors leaving it up to the committee.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions for the bill sponsor, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside. Bring up our next piece of legislation today, which is our final piece. Senate Bill 226, by the governor authorizing certificates of participation for the construction of a crime lab and a life science building. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent is to hear from the sponsor, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today from the Department of Revenue is Mr. Devin Mitchell, debt manager. If he can come forward, please. Mr. Mitchell, you've been here numerous times before, so you know the drill.
For the record, my name is Devin Mitchell. I'm the debt manager for the state of Alaska and the Department of Revenue. So were you looking for me to run through the bill briefly, Mr. Chair?
Well, it's the opportunity, I think, to explain to the committee and the public at home what a certificate of participation is. We should touch on some of the financial ways we can, our financial packages that can be put together to move projects forward in the state, and then you may want to speak to the issues at hand, although we're going to start the capital budget process tomorrow at the university, and the life science building will be a point of discussion along with later on in the process. The crime lab.
Thanks for the clarification, Mr. Chair. I ask because it's a little unusual for the financing to be the lead on a bill that's really about projects. But to quickly run through the bill as it's currently drafted, there's two projects that are envisioned to be partially funded by certificates of participation. $75.8 million for the Department of Public Safety's Crime Lab in Anchorage. That project has already been partially funded by direct appropriation. Design work's been done. The project's ready to go. There are others here that could speak more directly on that aspect of it. But time is of the essence with that project as far as being able to take advantage of the coming construction season. The other project, the $109.5 million for the life science building on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus, $88.9 million of that being funded with certificates of participation. An additional amount, the bill currently allows $20.6 million of University of Alaska revenue bonds. That amount, I've talked to the university system financial folks, and there will, if this were to proceed, there would need to be an amendment to that amount to provide for a funding of a reserve and cost of issuance at the university level. That's the structure that's required for the revenue bonds that are envisioned at for that component of the financing. As far as the certificates of participation, it's a mechanism that the state has used a number of times. I've heard some folks referred to a recent financing of the Goose Creek Correctional Facility as a COP. That's in fact incorrect. That was a lease revenue bond. It's a subtle distinction, but a distinction nonetheless. These are state of Alaska obligations on the top of the prospectus. The Goose Creek Correctional Facility was Matanuska-Susitna Borough issuance, and so their name was on the top of the prospectus as the issuer. how this is facilitated, is the certificates of participation are facilitated, is, as the name implies, there's an ability of an investor to participate through a certificate in the obligation that the state enters into. And so we have a lease that's established between the Department of Administration and a trustee that's given a title interest in the facility that's being funded. That lease is fractionalized into $5,000 blocks, which are the size of any bond issue that might be sold, and offered based on the structure that you want to pay debt service on. And so if we want typically level debt service over a 20-year period, we'll have a maturity in each one of the years between now and 20 years from now, and those maturities will have different interest rates, which will determine based on, which would be determined based on the market at the point in time the certificates were sold. So it's very similar to a bond issue, but it's, I think the difference really lies from our perspective as the state of Alaska, is that it is a means of the legislature funding discrete projects without having to go to a vote of the population of the state and the corresponding requirement that you have a larger project list to include all of the various regions of the state to generate the supports that's required to pass a general obligation bond issue. So it's been used a number of times in the past for buildings here in Juneau, like the Court Plaza building, for buildings in Anchorage, like the Fairbanks Courthouse, for correctional facilities, not the Goose Creek Correctional Facility, but Wildwood on the Kenai Peninsula was funded through a certificate of participation, the Anchorage Times building in Anchorage. So projects around the state have been funded using that mechanism. The other question that I've not been asked by you directly, but have heard otherwise, was why would you want to use COPs versus general obligation bonds? And again, it's because you have a couple of priority projects that you want to fund. If you have more things that you want to fund through the use of debt, then it might lend itself to general obligation bonds. Two discrete projects like this might not be the type of funding that you would want to undertake through general obligation bonds, because of the more likely scenarios that the voters wouldn't approve it. We're also in a situation right now where if we wait until the general election to consider a general obligation bond route, we're going to lose a construction season because we're going to have uncertainty related to our financing until the voters approve it. So if that's November, then obviously we can't enter into contracts to build anything until we have funding in hand. And we also have the risk that we wouldn't be able to access some of the provisions of the the Recovery Act provides for a program that we've talked about in committee before, the Build America Bond Program, whereby an issuer that otherwise would sell tax-exempt debt can sell taxable debt and receive a 35% subsidy from the federal government on that taxable debt. Because of the benefit of that 35% subsidy, you wind up with a lower yield than you would in the true tax-exempt market. And so where normally a 20-year maturity might be in the 4.5% interest range, right now you're going to be much closer to 4 or perhaps even through 4 on a Build America bond structure. And so there's a benefit of 50 to 100 basis points to using the structure. And if the law stays the way it is, that opportunity goes away at the end of 2010. If we have a November election, it's going to be very difficult to access the market in time to take advantage of that. We could be all queued up in advance of the election, take some actions assuming that something would pass, and maybe have the first week of December, because you can't sell bonds. They recommend you don't sell bonds the week of Thanksgiving, because the market loses interest a bit. You lose some of the accounts because it's the way the market works. And then after about the 15th, you start losing accounts as well. It's the holiday season and folks are interested in other things, and as a result, you suffer a bit in your pricing. And the same thing would occur if the Build America Bond program is going away. There's going to be a significant demand to access the market at the end of the calendar year, and as you know, supply and demand, well, yields are going to go up. And so there's, I guess the COP route has been suggested for timing purposes on a couple of fronts, and okay, the fact that we have a couple of standalone projects.
Okay. Maybe we could have the Deputy Commissioner come forward, Mr. Burnett. So this is the governor's bill. Mr. Mitchell was on the list as the presenter. I'm sure you have other duties that you would like to do, so you must have showed up for something. So I assume this is the something.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jerry Burnett. I'm Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. I actually came to observe, and so I have no additional testimony, but I would like to reiterate what Mr. Mitchell said about the Build America bonds and the rush to sell bonds likely at the end of this year. If we were with a general obligation bond and the Build America bond program, which may go away, or if not go away, the proposals in Congress are to reduce the subsidy from 35% to 28%. That's likely to be a big rush for financing toward the end of calendar year 2010 with other states. I've talked to the treasurers from a number of other states, and they're utilizing bonds financing to reduce their ongoing operating costs and to actually substitute for their general fund revenues this year. So there's a huge demand. And the timing issue here should be something that you should take seriously.
So did your administration take a look at just paying cash and not worrying about, you know, the trying to shave off 50 or 70 basis points off the debt instrument, but basically just cash it out, the buildings?
Mr. Chair, that actually it's OMB that makes the budgeting decisions on the question of cash or debt. But at this point, as Mr. Mitchell testified, we're looking at interest rates which are likely to be an effective interest rate sub 4% or near 4%. In the current market today, it would be below 4% if we were actually had the authorization we're issuing these. Our long-term earnings on the general fund, the main account of the CBR, are above the cost of this capital. So it's not an irrational decision to have a portfolio where you have some debt. I don't think the state of Alaska has an excessive amount of debt, and we have savings which are allows the legislature a greater amount of flexibility for the future if you do finance some projects and pay cash for others.
Okay. We have any initial questions, Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, you talked about the potential of losing 1 year in construction if we don't go through the COPs. How many years has this project been under consideration for construction?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I'm not an expert on the project side of the proposal. I do know that the Department of Public Safety's proposal has been before the legislature in various committees in each of the last two sessions, and as a result of that, there was a partial funding of the facility that included the total design and some ground preparation. I'm not certain on the life science building.
Substantially more than 2 years, I think, would be a fair assumption. Senator Hoffman, we'll ask. We'll have a representative from the university come forward a little later. We can get a better and more accurate answer.
That was my point. You know, we're talking about losing a year, but this project has been under consideration for several years, probably half a decade.
So do we have further questions, initial questions, Administration, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure I understand that the Build America bonds are 35%. How does the 35% work in relationship to those?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas. So there's a bond issued on a taxable basis. So the investor, instead of receiving interest tax exempt, receives a taxable rate of interest. The issuer receives the benefit of the tax exempt status, if you will. So in the normal world, the investor received the benefit and they shifted that over to the issuer. So it's a direct subsidy to the issuer rather than a subsidy to the investor. That 35% would flow back to the state of Alaska's general fund as debt service was paid on a semi-annual basis.
And if go ahead, follow.
And with that in mind, you're saying also that the sub-account of the CBR, which is earning an interest rate in excess of what is estimated to be the build or the COP bonding.
I think we're referring to the main account of the CBR.
Oh, okay.
What I said, the general fund, the general investment account, and the main account of the CBR historically have earned an interest rate higher than what the cost of issuance would be for these at this point to the state. And if I could clarify what Devin Mitchell said about the way the Build America bonds works, the U.S. government gives a direct payment to the state of Alaska for the 35% subsidy of the interest. So we would be getting a check from the federal government, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And when does that money come?
That comes out of your income tax dollars, sir.
No, not where, but when is that money received?
Help us with the cash flow mechanism, yes. The timing of the cash flows.
So there is paperwork required, and you can pay a trustee, your paying agent, to undertake the work for a nominal fee, you know, $500 a year, and they will undertake the actions for you, or you can just undertake the actions yourself, whereby you submit paperwork to. Upon issuance of the bonds, you are required to file paperwork with the IRS, and then upon each successive interest payment, 3 months in advance of that, you make you file notice with the U.S. Treasury, and then upon payment, you receive your reimbursement. And so it's supposed to occur the next day, the same day. Basically, as you pay debt service.
Thank you.
We have any other initial questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, we have one fiscal note in the packet from the Department of Revenue showing the initial interest payment of $2,700,000 in general funds in FY11. We have several people online, and there's several people in the room. We'll start with the off-net. I'd like to try to keep the comments to a couple of minutes and try to be succinct so we can move through the process today. Start by identifying yourself for the record and who you represent, and then speak to Senate Bill 226. Myron Dosh.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 226. My name is Myron Dosh, Controller for the University of Alaska, and I oversee its debt function. My comments are directed to the life sciences portion of this bill and are primarily concerned with the proposed financing structure. I am in support of the financing structure. I would, however, like to propose some technical amendments to the bill, which I believe were just overlooked in the original drafting. But first, before I do so, just as a little bit of background, the university intends to issue general revenue bonds to pay for a portion of the construction costs. That amount is proposed in the governor's budget was $20.625 million. The debt would be issued with no less than a 20-year term, potentially a combination of tax-exempt security and Build America bonds. And we just went through that discussion regarding Build America bonds with Mr. Mitchell. So I won't go into that any further. But one thing to add in addition to that, the interest rate environment is low right now. It's one of the flip sides of the fiscal crisis, if you will. And so that's one of the things that makes it more palatable to do this project now from a financing point of view. The university has a AA credit rating, and issuing debt for this project is well within the university's debt capacity. The debt would be secured by the university's broad general revenue pledge, with payback primarily from indirect cost recovery associated with the indirect cost with the sponsored research activity expected to take place in the facility. We were trying this morning to get a copy of the amendments to the committee. I'm not sure that they were made or arrived, but briefly, the amendments that I would propose are in Section 5, Line 18. Currently in the bill, it says the maximum principal amount of the bonds that the University of Alaska may issue is $20.6 million. I would propose that that be increased to $24 million. The reason for this change is to provide a sufficient amount to cover the bond issuance costs, mandatory debt service reserves, and capitalized interest if necessary. It's common practice that these issuance costs, I'll refer to them as, are included in the bond, and essentially those bonds or those costs are paid through debt service over the life of the debt. Without this amendment and just leaving the principal amount capped at $20.6 million, it would actually take away monies needed for the construction costs or the bricks and mortar of the facility, if you will. So I just want to like to emphasize that this does not change or increase the amount for that construction cost. It still remains at $20.625 million, but this just provides authorization from the bill standpoint to provide for issuance costs. As a result of this change, and I won't go through each one of them, but several places in the bill, the total amount would therefore change to $112,875,000. The second amendment that I would propose is in Section 4, Subsection C, and this section refers to who has title or which entity has title to the building after certificates of participation would be issued. At the last, it currently reads that the title would vest with the state of Alaska. I believe this should read as the University of Alaska at the end of the payment of all debts. And finally, the other technical change would be in Section 4, Subsection A, regarding the authority to enter into a lease purchase agreement. Currently, it reads the University of Alaska. I believe this should say refer to the lease purchase agreement as the, or the state of Alaska as being the providing authorization to. That concludes my comments. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you for your testimony today. Seeing no questions, we'll go on to Jay Quackenbush. If you can identify yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Jay Quackenbush. I'm president of the Fairbanks Building and Construction Trades Council, and I've been a longtime supporter of University of Alaska, Fairbanks, and alumni. And I will admit I have learned a lot from listening to the previous speakers and the comments from the Finance Committee on what certificates of participation funding is. And in no way am I speaking as an expert, or, but I do want to speak in favor of the project after we after studying the facilities on campus over the last year and getting involved, it's pretty obvious that this life sciences facility is needed. And I feel from my participation in the community that Fairbanksons view this as very much needed. It's pretty embarrassing when you go through campus and you see ADCO units that are currently housing staff scientists and students. And we feel that a facility like the life sciences as designed would help secure the University of Alaska, you know, as the top, one of the top facilities in the nation when it comes to biological sciences. So I just wanted to express my support for it and do want to comment, just in case nobody from the Anchorage or the Juneau building trades is online, that those sectors of our state in the construction fields are also supportive of the life sciences facility. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll go now to Fairbanks. Lake Williams, if you could identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Lake Williams. I live at 221 Glacier Avenue. I'm president of the Fairbanks Central Labor Council and a representative for the operating engineers. I just want to say I'm strongly in favor of SB 226, which includes the Life Science Building. Life Science Building is a shovel-ready project that estimates in the short term will employ around 370 people. The long-term benefits estimate the state will get $6 back for every dollar invested. To me, this is a no-brainer. Alaska and Fairbanks need capital projects that will benefit Alaska long-term. From my understanding, putting this project out for public vote for bonding could delay the project up to 2 years or could even threaten the project if other projects are added to the bond proposal. Delaying the project would also add additional costs in the construction as far as labor and from what I learned today, potential costs in bonding. We elect senators and representatives to make the hard decisions, especially when it comes to spending state monies. We should not start a precedent of delaying needed capital projects that will provide jobs for local Alaskans and benefit the state long term, especially when our state coffers are overflowing. Alaska needs a life science building. Alaska needs the Sitna. Alaska needs the natural gas line. And we need other projects to provide economic engines for the future of our state. When you see a project like these in our crosshairs, it is your job as an elected official to pull the trigger. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes our off-net and our LIO sites. We'll come into the room. And we'll start with Commissioner Masters, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. For the record, my name is Joe Masters, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. And I'd like to, or I'm going to be testifying on the crime lab portion of the bill. And my testimony is primarily going to be geared towards the importance of the lab within the state. And I can answer some questions on the project itself, but also in the room we have the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Transportation, who can make a comment on the project, as well as Oren Dim, who's the crime lab manager. For specifics, if you have questions regarding the lab details itself, and then also there's another, Matt Tanaka, who's the project manager for the crime lab project. I'd also like to point out that we provided the committee a fairly concise but lengthy document on the, it's a briefing document on the crime lab, and I believe that was printed for you. I'm not going to go through this document, but it is provided for more detailed information if you need, but we can answer questions regarding it. I'd first like to discuss the importance of the lab and a new lab. Currently, Alaska is placed number one in the rankings for sexual assault ranked nationally. We're also ranked number 9 in the rates of violent crime. Scientific analysis and evidence is vital to providing prosecutors the information necessary to get prosecutions of these cases. The state crime lab currently, and this crime lab that's projected or proposed, is the only crime lab in the state and would be the only accredited crime lab in the state. This lab services not only the agencies of the state and the Department of Public Safety, but also services all police agencies for submission of evidence. Currently, we have a situation in our current lab where we have an overcrowded and inadequate facility, and this is the single largest limiter in our lab throughput. As a result, the lab must triage cases and must focus on increasing severity of cases and put lower level crimes and more minor crimes to the side. Over the years, the lab has also had to discontinue services as we triage cases and as we focus more on these specific types of sciences for those cases. For example, over the years, we've discontinued shoe and tire impressions, DNA and property crimes cases, wildlife evidence, trace evidence, hair and fiber, paint, glass, and those types of services. This lab would restore those services in the state, as well as allow us to continue to add more critical services, such as toxicology and others. Also, I wanted to point out that agencies have learned that the current lab cannot support requests for property crimes and are choosing not to submit evidence. Recent surveys of police departments indicate that there could be as much as double the submissions of evidence out there that we are currently receiving. The cumulative result has been where the crime lab was once a leader in scientific analysis amongst state crime labs nationally, we are now a trailer. We are years behind the implementation of scientific techniques that are currently being used in other state and municipal labs around the country. In order to be effective, we need to restore these capabilities. The lab has evolved over the years, at least specifically the past 6 years, to focus on major crimes only as opposed to all crimes. This means the lab is taking a reactive approach to crime investigation instead of the preferred proactive approach of crime prevention. And what I mean by this is that this is a case because the preventative effect of convicting offenders for property crimes and other lower level crimes before they become major offenders is not realized. As far as the project is concerned, $18 million has already been appropriated by the legislature in previous years for the investment in design, review, and site prep, as well as several thorough reviews subsequent. We already have a pad have already run the electrical and sewer utilities for that pad. So we are literally at the point where within a few months we can be putting up walls in this case. As a matter of fact, the project manager said that we would be pouring concrete as early as May. DOT will testify that delay will be caused, a delay will be caused by moving out of the current CLP process, if not approved this year, into the GO bonds. This result not only increases costs, as will be testified to, but a delay in the capability to deliver the critical services that are already needed today. This in a very real way impacts the safety and our public and our communities. Investing in this lab allows us to meet our current needs, as well as allows us the ability and flexibility to continue to meet our needs into the future. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to close my remarks, and as I pointed out, there are certainly other project folks here that can answer more questions. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much would the operational cost be for the first year of this facility?
The operating costs, I want to refrain from giving you a ballpark figure, but I know that the project manager has those figures, and I believe they are contained within the document.
How many new positions would there be in the facility?
Initially, we're projecting at opening after 2 years of the construction period of only adding not nominal number, of which will only be several positions, primarily to operate the facility, and then some for the lab technician work. The approach that we took for the lab design of the way it's projected or proposed in front of you allows us or gives us a way to manage growth into the future so we can look at and evaluate current technologies where we're at and also techniques and sciences as they come online and determine how best to employ this in the future. So we do have a 10-year plan on bringing these new sciences on board, and new positions would be added with those new sciences.
And the other question, Mr. Chairman, is what would the existing facility be used for?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, currently we have not made a final determination of what the current lab facility would be used for. We have determined that it could not be without very significant renovation and reconstruction, I suppose, to be used as a lab. It certainly could be used as office space, and currently I know that there are other state entities, but also the Department of Public Safety, that does have need for added facility space.
And if there is nothing determined for use of that facility, how much would it cost to mothball that facility?
Through the chairman, I don't have a figure. As you state, I believe that could be one of the other speakers that would be able to answer that question. To restore that facility to being an operable crime lab that would not meet the needs of the state would be an upwards of $10 to $12 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can get back to the committee, if you could, on what the expectations is of the department for staffing levels and few things, although we're going to have this issue, like I mentioned earlier today, back up before us under the capital budget. So we'll have time to flush out some of those details. Do we have any other questions for Commissioner Masters? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner. I've been reading through your handout, and it displays that about almost 20% of the building will be unfinished.
When we get to talk about specific detail, I'd like to bring somebody else up to the table to answer those questions. But there is an approach where we would shell out space initially and build into that space for added sciences coming on. It's not 40%. I believe that shelled out space is more about 19%.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I guess my concern is when we dealt with this project several years ago, it was going to be at $100 million. And now we're dealing with a building that 20% is not going to be finished, and it's $100 million, roughly. But we can talk about that in more detail.
Okay. Any other questions for the commissioner? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to comment. I appreciate on page 24 you talk about the coordination with lab project experts and lab designers, as well as the contractor. I certainly appreciate that. Know that that's worked well for us in the Fairbanks area, where you have a contractor that kind of generally tempers the design architect's particular signatures you may want to apply to buildings. So I just wanted to say that I appreciate working with a local contractor in the designs that's familiar with the construction needs.
We have about a little less than 10 minutes, and if we could wrap this up, we won't have to come back at 1:30. So, do we have any other questions for the commissioner? Okay, seeing none. And then the commissioner will work with your office, and we'll get some of the questions answered that were brought up today.
Thank you, sir.
And next up is Don Etheridge. Etheridge, if you can identify yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Etheridge. I'm here on behalf of the Alaska State AFL-CIO, and we are fully supportive of this piece of legislation. We think it is time to start construction, and we need some jobs out there, and this will be a good step in getting some of those jobs on the street. And it's also a benefit to the existing workers to have a facility that's they're able to do their job properly in. So we're fully supportive of it.
Okay, thank you. I would expect nothing else. Russell Presley from the university. Nobody's here under that title. That's the only folks we have signed up, although I see the Deputy Commissioner DOT coming forward. So do you have, you want to come forward and take a minute, and then we're going to conclude today?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quickly, Frank Richards, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I have with me Mr. Matt Tanaka. Quickly, I just wanted to identify the benefits of the crime lab construction in calendar year 2010. With the current funding package as presented by the administration with the COP, we could likely be under construction this spring and summer, essentially creating jobs immediately, and with the numbers estimating between 125 to 150 jobs underway with laborers, carpenters, electricians, pipe fitters, iron workers, and other trades. That the cost of going to, or delay of this project by a year of going out for general obligation bond, we estimate to be approximately $3 million, or adding an additional 4% due to the delay of the project and the escalation. The lab costs that we've presented to you in this package are valid. What Mr. Tanaka has done on previous labs with the UAF and DEC labs, we have square footage costs that are in range with what we've produced previously. I've asked Mr. Tanaka to come to the table if there are specific technical questions that he may be able to answer.
And we are out of time, so if you can, if you want to make a couple of quick points.
Well, this is Mr. Tanaka.
And who do you represent?
The Department of Transportation. I'm the project manager. This project's been underway for a number of years and has been before the legislature before, as you know. That underscores the level of detail that's been put into the project. We're beyond shovel ready. Right now we are literally hammer ready. We have a contractor under contract, and we have actually completed $8 million worth of construction this past summer. If funded with certificates of participation this spring, we'll be into construction this May. If delayed into GO bonds, the delay will give rise to $3 million worth of escalation costs, which will partially offset savings that may arise, if any, from alternative funding schemes. We have answers. So during this process, if you have questions, we can certainly come back with information. It's at our fingertips.
Okay, thank you. That concludes the meeting today. Tomorrow, March 16th, 9 a.m., we'll begin the department overviews of the FY11 capital budget. Meeting adjourned.